So, as James said, we're reading Ruth chapter 1, page 267. In the days when the judges ruled, there was a famine in the land. So a man from Bethlehem in Judah, together with his wife and two sons, went to live for a while in the country of Moab. The man's name was Elimelech, his wife's name was Naomi, and the names of his two sons were Mahlon and Chilion. They were Ephrathites from Bethlehem, Judah, and they went to Moab and lived there. Now Elimelech, Naomi's husband, died, and she was left with her two sons. They married Moabite women, one named Orpah and the other Ruth. After they had lived there about 10 years, both Mahlon and Chilion also died, and Naomi was left without her two sons and her husband. When Naomi heard in Moab that the Lord had come to the aid of his people by providing food for them, she and her daughters-in-law prepared to return home from there. With her two daughters-in-law, she left the place where she had been living and set out on the road that would take them back to the land of Judah. Then Naomi said to her two daughters-in-law, "Go back, each of you, to your mother's home. May the Lord show you kindness, as you have shown kindness to your dead husbands and to me. May the Lord grant that each of you will find rest in the home of another husband." Then she kissed them goodbye, and they wept aloud and said to her, "We will go back with you to your people." But Naomi said, "Return home, my daughters. Why would you come with me? Am I going to have any more sons who could become your husbands? Return home, my daughters. I am too old to have another husband. Even if I thought there was still hope for me, even if I had a husband tonight and then gave birth to sons, would you wait until they grew up? Would you remain unmarried for them? No, my daughters, it is more bitter for me than for you, because the Lord's hand has turned against me." At this, they wept aloud again. Then Orpah kissed her mother-in-law goodbye, but Ruth clung to her. "Look," said Naomi, "your sister-in-law is going back to her people and her gods. Go back with her." But Ruth replied, "Don't urge me to leave you or to turn back from you. Where you go, I will go, and where you stay, I will stay. Your people will be my people, and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. May the Lord deal with me, be it ever so severely, if even death separates you and me." When Naomi realized that Ruth was determined to go with her, she stopped urging her. So the two women went on until they came to Bethlehem. When they arrived in Bethlehem, the whole town was stirred because of them. And the women exclaimed, Can this be Naomi? "Don't call me Naomi," she told them. "Call me Mara, because the Almighty has made my life very bitter. I went away full, but the Lord has brought me back empty. Why call me Naomi? The Lord has afflicted me. The Almighty has brought misfortune upon me." So Naomi returned from Moab, accompanied by Ruth the Moabite, her daughter-in-law, arriving in Bethlehem as the barley harvest was beginning.
Donna, thank you very much. Good afternoon, everybody. It's very nice to be with you. We're going to be beginning a little mini-series in Ruth these next few weeks. In chapter 1, page 267 is what we're going to be thinking through today. But as we begin, let me just tell you a little story. Over the Christmas break, just between Christmas, that funny time between Christmas and New Year, we popped to my in-laws for a few days down in the West Country, and had the chance to go and stay with a mate who lives not too far from there. Just popped in for a cup of tea and about my 54th mince pie. And just as I had a lovely time with him, but as we were leaving, he said, "Oh, Andy, have you seen what's on the wall behind you?" And I turned around in the hallway, and it was a picture about this large on an old bit of paper where the mouse had eaten a corner of one bit. But it was a family tree. I don't know if you've ever done your sort of family tree. This went back 20 generations. And the last input, because they ran out of room, was in something like 1909. It was an extraordinary thing. I've never been able to trace someone's family tree back that far. It was really quite impressive. Of course, because I'm quite dull, I didn't realise until sort of the following day that actually that's a bit like what we're going to be doing in Ruth. We're going to be going back through Jesus' family tree. That's what we'll do as we look at Ruth, this book of Ruth. You see, this little book of Ruth, it's only small, isn't it? It's squashed between 21 chapters in Judges and 55 chapters in Samuel. So in our Bible timeline, Ruth is happening during the time of the Judges. It may be very small in terms of word count, but actually it is massive in terms of significance. Because in the little book of Ruth, we get to see a huge part of Jesus' family tree. Its focus is on a single family rather than a nation, but is very significant in terms of God's plans for his whole world. We've been thinking about that, haven't we, over the Christmas period. God's great plan of salvation for the world fulfilled in the birth of Jesus Christ. And here in Ruth, you may have picked up just a little few hints, aren't there? There's some Christmassy bits in the book of Ruth. Not the fact that it takes place in Bethlehem, but if you've read through the four chapters, you'll know that King David gets a mention at the end, is excitement over the birth of a very precious, longed-for child. And of course, Ruth herself, well, she appears in Jesus' family tree at the beginning of Matthew's gospel. If that's the bigger picture, let's jump in then to verse 1, where it begins, like many books, gives us the when and the where of what's going on. So we see there in verse 1 of chapter 1, we are in the days when the judges ruled. So that helps us mark it in history, as it were, on our Bible timeline. It was Charles Dickens who famously begins his novel Tale of Two Cities with the words, "It was the best of times, it was the worst of times." Well, as Ruth begins, one would struggle to see how the days when the judges ruled were anything but the worst of times. Now, why do I say that? It should be the best of times, shouldn't it? They were in slavery in Egypt, but again, God rescues them during the Exodus and brings them to the promised land. It should be a place where they enjoy peace and rest. Should be where they enjoy being in right relationship with God himself, their rescuer, their redeemer. It should be the best of times, the days of the judges. But just look back over the page, page 266, the last verse in the book of Judges summarizes the whole thing for us. In those days, the days of the judges, Israel had no king. Everyone did as they saw fit. You see, the days of the judges are a real low point in Israel's history. No king doesn't just mean there's no speech to listen to on Christmas Day. It means everyone does what is right in their own eyes. Everyone does as they see fit. Everyone makes up the rules as they go along. They decide for themselves what is right or wrong, and they serve only themselves. That's hardly a recipe, is it, for peace and goodwill? Hence, the book of Judges actually makes for really grim reading. See, what happens is God's people in the promised land, the land of promise, but they keep wandering off and doing their own thing apart from God. A phrase that keeps coming up in Judges is they do evil in the eyes of the Lord. Now, as a result of that, things keep going horribly wrong in the book of Judges. It's only when they're desperate that they actually cry out to God, not as a first port of call, but as a last resort. And what happens? Well, because God is forgiving and merciful, he sends a judge, that is a rescuer or a ruler who brings peace to the land for a while. And this is a cycle, because what happens after a while is, well, they turn away from God again. And if you were to go away and read the book of Judges, it would take a bit longer than Ruth, but you'd see this cycle happening again and again and again. Well, it's during this time, selfishness and sadness, violence and oppression, disobedience and despair, we're going to zoom in and focus on this single family living in Israel. Given it's the worst of times, it should come as no surprise then that chapter 1 contains its fair share of sadness and despair as well. Now, the book of Ruth itself is a story full of hope. We move from famine to fortune, emptiness to fullness, death to life. That's where we're headed the next few weeks. But it's not where we begin, is it? We begin in the days when the judges ruled. If that's when our story starts, we also need to think about where it starts. Verse 1, we're in Bethlehem, in Judah, in the promised land. The land that God promised he would bring his rescue people to. That's where we are. But verse 2, Elimelech, Naomi, they're living in Bethlehem, in Judah, in the promised land. But we see that they're not going to stay there. They decide to move to Moab. And as we'll see through this chapter, the decisions that people make are a key feature of what's going on in chapter 1. We have a verb here, the verb to turn or turn back or return. It's mentioned 12 times in this one chapter. Now, in our translation, it's tweaked a little so as not to sound too repetitive. I don't know if you had the same experience as me at primary school. You had to write a story. The teacher would tell you to not keep repeating words. You'd have to come up with different ones, wouldn't you, to make it more exciting. So you'd have to dig out your thesaurus and find a variation. But in Hebrew, which is what Ruth is written in originally, that repetition of the same word is really important. See, we're better off ditching the thesaurus and grabbing a highlighter. See, if we were reading this in Hebrew, 12 times the same word would jump out at you. Turn, return, turn back. All the same word. Which helps us as a reader to know that the direction of travel, as it were, is key to understanding what this chapter is all about. With that in mind, then, let's head to our first heading. There's two this afternoon, and here's the first one. Elimelech and Naomi's turning away from the promised land brings emptiness. You may know that the word Bethlehem translates as house of bread. But we see there's a problem, don't we? There is no bread in the house of bread. There is a famine in the land. But Elimelech and his family hear that there is food in Moab, which is sort of next door but one. So they choose to move there. Now, on the face of it, because of the famine, their move to Moab might look like a good idea. It's just a pragmatic thing. It's expedient to do this sort of thing. We have no food here, so let's go where there's food. Except it's not that simple. You see, the original reader, their jaw would drop at this point. They'd spit out their tea. They'd choke on a biscuit. Move where? To Moab. You can't be serious. You see, Moab wasn't neutral. It's not like moving from Arborfield to Barkham. See, what we have here isn't just a change of postcodes. It's not just born out of pragmatism. It signals, actually, a change of heart. Because what they're leaving behind is the promised land. And with it, the Lord who made those promises. See, up until this point in Israel's history, Moab has only ever been the enemy. We read about this in Judges itself. For 18 years, the Moabites enslaved the Israelites. And not only that, in Moab, well, they worship other gods. Their behavior is marked by idolatry and immorality and other grotesque religious practices. Move to Moab, Elimelech. You can't be serious. But there's more to it even than that, because although things were bad in Bethlehem and in Israel, there was a reason for the famine, and it wasn't just the weather. You see, when God rescued his people from slavery in Egypt, brought them through the wilderness and into the promised land, he told them, now that you're here, if you honor me, then things will go well for you. They'd enjoy a blessed, good relationship with God, as well as all that the promised land had to offer, the land of milk and honey. So they'd enjoy resting under God's loving rule and blessing as God's people in God's land. In the promised land, they'd know shalom. But God says, listen, if you dishonor me, indeed, if you disobey me, then actually, if you go and do your own thing, end of Judges, do as you see fit, well, things will go badly. There would be consequences. Disaster would come in one form or another. Now, the purpose of those consequences was always to wake them up to what they were doing, to bring them to their senses, to encourage them to realize that their relationship is out of order, that their relationship with God is therefore on the rocks, because of how they've behaved. And we read in Deuteronomy, significantly, one of those consequences would be famine. So this famine in the days when everyone did as they saw fit, it's not just a lack of bread, it's a lack of trust in God. It's a sign to them that something is very, very wrong. It's a shaking of their shoulders saying, look, you need to be humbled. You need to turn back to God, the one from whom you've turned away. Turn back to him. Repent. It's a warning sign. So Elimelech and Naomi, they have a decision to make. They can either understand the famine for what it is, a call to return to God, knowing that he is gracious, compassionate, kind, forgiving, their proven rescuer and redeemer. There's a famine, something's wrong, we need to turn back to God. Or they can turn away from him, turn away from the promised land and turn to Moab. Elimelech's name translates as God is my king. But in painful irony, Elimelech chooses to do what is right in his own eyes and turn away. He should know that man cannot live on bread alone, but they choose to give it a go anyway in Moab. So they're not looking with the eyes of faith, are they, to what God has promised? They're not listening to God. Instead, they look to what they can see over the fence in Moab. And so in thinking that the grass is greener, they turn, but they turn their backs on God. They flee from the land of promise and head to Moab, the land of compromise or compromise. And if we've been a Christian for any length of time here this afternoon, don't we all know that temptation ourselves? Especially in a moment of crisis. Things aren't going as we would like, so we ignore the promises God has made to us as Christians, the promises that are yes in Christ Jesus. You see, if we're a Christian here this afternoon, the promise of land that we see in the Old Testament, peace, rest, security, provision, faithfulness, blessing, all those things they were to enjoy in the promised land, they're all now fulfilled in Jesus. So as Christians, we enjoy those promises in a person, not in a postcode. Jesus promises to give us everything we need. Not everything we want, but everything we need. But when we don't receive what we want, well, then we can do what we see fit. We take matters into our own hands. That's the temptation, to do what is right in our own eyes instead, to turn to Moab. The grass will be greener over there. So it is with a heavy heart that we should read of what Elimelech and Naomi decide to do, to turn to Moab. But as we read on, we see that the sorrow is only just beginning. They're settled in Moab. It was going to be for a little while. They end up spending 10 years there. And they suffer much tragedy. Moab seemed to promise life, all the things they didn't have. But for this family, it brings only death and sadness. We read of how Elimelech dies. And then a decade later, Naomi's two sons die as well. And on top of all the heartache she faces as a mother, it's even worse because in the culture of the day, she didn't just lose her loved ones. She lost her status, her security, and means of provision. I met with a guy earlier this week. In the past 12 months, he told me how an aunt and an uncle had died, and then his mother has died just last week. Real sadness, as he told me that story. But it can be hard, can't it, for us to empathize with all that Naomi goes through in these verses. We do get some sense of her pain towards the end of the chapter, verse 20. She says, look, don't call me Naomi, that means pleasant. Call me Mara, because my life is bitter. And again in verse 21, she says, look, I used to be full. I went away full. And I've come back empty. I left with a husband and two sons. I come back with only their memory. But as we consider verse 21, it is a helpful summary of what Naomi goes through in this chapter, but it's also a hopeful summary. Did you notice the return word there? Naomi says, I went away. But the Lord has brought me back. That brought me back word is the return word. The Lord has returned me. See, Naomi, in all her bitter suffering, she's convinced the Lord hasn't abandoned her. In fact, it's the Lord, she says, who has brought her back. Back where? Well, to the land of promise, to the land of blessing, where not only has Naomi come back, but the harvest has come back as well. In all she goes through, Naomi never actually turns her back on God entirely, does she? For as sad as all this is for her, and it's something she's brutally honest about to God, she never abandons God. And so as the chapter ends, there is a hint that this isn't the end of Naomi's story. But there's more too, isn't it? When she says, look, I've come back empty, we might scratch our heads a little bit and think, well, hang on, who stood right next to you, Naomi? What about your daughter-in-law who's come with you, Ruth? Well, that brings us to our second heading. Ruth's turning to the promised land reveals her loving commitment to the Lord. You see, on hearing that there is bread in Bethlehem once more, verse 6, the Lord is again providing for his people, Naomi says, well, it's time to leave the compromised land and return to the promised land herself. So off she goes along with Orpah and Ruth. But then in verse 7, they've left their home, they're on the road back to Bethlehem, and they pause. They reach a crossroad. Decisions need to be made. Which way are people going to turn? And as emotional as the goodbye is, Naomi seems very keen, doesn't she, for her daughters-in-law to return home to Moab. Naomi's point is simply that as far as her daughters-in-law are concerned, the cupboard is still bare in Bethlehem. Yes, the bread is back, but there is no future for these women in that country. So verse 14, Orpah returns to Moab. But very strikingly, Ruth, we're told, clings to Naomi. See, verse 15, Ruth looks as Naomi encourages her to, and she sees what Moab has to offer. But actually, with the eyes of faith, Ruth turns to Naomi. She turns towards Bethlehem. She turns towards God's people and towards the Lord. They are remarkable words in verses 16 and 17. Do look at them again with me as I read them. Ruth replies to Naomi, don't urge me to leave you or to turn back from you. Where you go, I will go. And where you stay, I will stay. Your people will be my people and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die and there I will be buried. May the Lord deal with me, be it ever so severely, if even death separates you and me. Ruth's commitment to Naomi is very clear, isn't it? But it's not just a commitment to Naomi. Ruth commits to stay living in the promised land even after Naomi dies. She calls a curse down on herself should she ever leave the land. And she commits not just to Naomi, but to the people of the promised land. Your people will be my people. And most significantly, to the God of the promised land. Your God will be my God. The language that Ruth uses here is very significant. A couple of times already, this is the language that God uses. In Exodus and in Leviticus, it'll be echoed throughout the Old Testament, actually, where God says, I will be your God, and you will be my people. Ruth here turns around and says, your God will be my God, and your people will be my people. Ruth echoes the words of the Lord in her commitment to the Lord. So it's safe to say, I think, that the past 10 years, this decade in Moab, in spite of all the tragedy that's befallen them as a family, as well as the flawed reasoning of Elimelech and Naomi to go there in the first place, along with their compromised witness, let's live by what we see rather than by faith. In amongst all of that mess, Ruth has come to understand and appreciate for herself something of the beauty and the majesty and the trustworthiness and the loveliness and the faithfulness of the Lord. the God of the Bible. She's learned that from her in-laws. She wouldn't learn that anywhere else in Moab. But she's seen and heard something of that in her in-laws. I was thinking about this earlier. I'd love it if the day I first became a Christian, I could have used language as beautiful as Ruth's. I didn't. But it is wonderful, isn't it? The way she knows, she understands who God is. And she says, I want to follow that God. I want to be a part of his people. I understand something of his faithfulness to them. I want to know that faithfulness for myself. Ruth knows the Lord is gracious and compassionate, slow to anger, abounding in love and faithfulness. And so she entrusts her life to him. So verse 15, Naomi says, look, go back to Moab. She's not going to go, is she? Ruth won't return to Moab, to their gods and the people there, because she's following the one true God, holding to his promise. She's committed now to God's people. And so it isn't just a physical journey, is it, for Ruth to Bethlehem? It is a deeply spiritual one as well. She's not just changing her address. It's been a change of heart. So it is then that Naomi returns, but she doesn't return alone to Bethlehem. Ruth turns to Bethlehem as well. And as I say, the chapter ends with a glimmer of hope. We began with famine. We read that the barley harvest is beginning in verse 22. So our story is well underway by the end of chapter 1. We will still have lots of questions. There's lots that we're not told. There's things that are still yet to happen in this story. But let me just leave one question with you to be thinking through in the week ahead. Which way are we facing? What is our current direction of travel? People's turning and returning is the drumbeat of the chapter here. So it's good for us to be thinking through our own turning and returning. If you're here this afternoon, you wouldn't yet call yourself a Christian. I hope you're encouraged by what you see in Ruth here. Let me explain why. Because in her turning and committing herself to God and his people, she has understood and echoes God's commitment to all and any who turn to him. Anyone who turns to the Lord and says, will you be my God and your people be my people? God says, I would love to be your God. I would love to take you as one of my people. See, as a Moabite, given all the history, we might have assumed Ruth would be turned away, unwelcome, not invited to be a part of God's people. Turning is simply not an option for someone like Ruth. She's from Moab. But we're reminded that God welcomes all who turn to him, regardless of background or merit. That's why when Jesus came to earth, he offered rest to the weary, not the religious. Jesus offered rest to the burdened, not the brilliant. See, in Jesus, there is just as much a welcome for the Moabite as the marginalized, the flawed and the fragile. All who turn will be saved. But if we are a Christian here this afternoon, we need to check our heads and our hearts, don't we? And check that they're not being turned, thinking the grass is greener somewhere away from Jesus. We'll all face seasons of struggling to trust that God is actually for us. So the repeated language of turning and returning encourages us to stop and think, well, which way am I facing at the moment? Am I looking towards Moab, thinking, well, maybe the grass is greener over there? Am I being tempted to live by sight rather than by faith? Tempted by what I see might be on offer rather than what God has promised to me is already mine? 2023 was a disorientating year, wasn't it, in many ways? And circumstances can do strange things to our hearts. So which way are we facing? Are we walking by faith towards Bethlehem, towards Jesus, the Christ, our King? Or is our heart turned away, thinking life can be found in all its fullness away from Jesus? Thinking, actually, if I do as I see fit, everything will work out just fine. If that's you, may I encourage you to return We are all prone to wander. Naomi went away, but that wasn't the end of her story. The Lord brought her back. Naomi wandered, but it wasn't the end of her story. The Lord went and fetched her. If we are wandering now, we need to know that the Lord is committed to us and he's calling us to return. Even though we will be faithless at times, he is always faithful. So even though Naomi is going through a very rough time, there's no doubting that, is there? She never abandons God. But she did have to pack her bags and head back home to Bethlehem. And maybe some of us need to be doing that as well.